Hey y'all, how's it going? God dang spammers, I don't need a VA loan. I've known since I was a boy better than to join up the U.S. military. That spam just keeps coming. Can't be stopped. Hi. What a ridiculous way to start a show to tell you about the spam in my email box. Anyway, whatever. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Yeah, sometimes it's a little disjointed, but at least I'm good on everything, you know. Today on the show, Gareth Porter's going to be on. And yeah, he's got some big news for us today. Did you see the spotlight on antiwar.com? Well, I don't want to spoil it for you. But a good friend, Gareth Porter, is going to be here, to talk about Iran. Maybe you could get his article read in a break or two during the show today, if you want to. Also, Jason Ditz is going to be back on the show. You know, I ought to just interview Jason Ditz all day, every day. That guy knows everything about everything. That's kind of his job, knowing everything about everything. He's really good. I really do hope you guys are reading antiwar.com, and what you'll see at the top of the page in those top headlines, many of those are addressed to news.antiwar.com, and that's Jason. He's the news editor there, and he's reading every story in the world all day, and he's writing up the news summaries for you and linking to the different sources of who's saying what about what, getting it right for you, and then sending you on your way back to the factual information, the original sourcing or whatever it is. And but he's just keeping up with every crisis on Earth, man. That's news.antiwar.com, the great Jason Ditz. And then Jonathan Landay is going to be here, not on Iraq, although I might could ask him some Iraq things maybe. But he's got a new piece all about the Senate torture report, which is extremely important. And what's good about that, too, is old Landay knows a lot about the torture program. He's been writing about it all along. So I got some other questions. You know, I am aware that a great many listeners of this show are very young, and to them the Bush years and the second Iraq war was kind of happened when they were kids, and they don't really know about it. That era was before, but they're paying attention now, so there's a lot to go over for those unfamiliar. That's not just the young, it's people who just decided to start paying attention, or like quite a few emails I've gotten lately. Soldiers, active duty, and former soldiers, including officers, saying, boy, was I wrong about everything, and your show has really helped get me straight. I got one of those right in front of me right now. Oh, no, this guy wasn't a vet. He was just a former warmonger. Somewhere here was a vet, though. Earlier today, I answered one from a vet. I get those, so. Yeah, always try to remind people of perspective, especially like for people who fought in the Iraq war and their officers never told them what the hell was going on. And then they hear me kind of explain, well, so in 2005, the predominant kind of forces going on were these and those and in conflict over this and that. And, you know, things fall into place and make a little bit more sense. Oh, yeah, I always knew I didn't like whichever son of a bitch, but now I understand who he was working for and how he fooled George Bush into working for him and etc. So, that's good. You know, it ain't changing the world, but at least it's a place where people can go to learn the truth, right? I mean, as close as I can get to it. That's interesting. Yeah. All right, so yeah, also on the show today, Ebola news coverage. Ooh, Israel, Palestine. Got some fun stuff to talk about there. Fun as in horrible. The cops, Barrett Brown. It'll be a pretty full show, and I'd like to take some calls. You know, it's Friday. I think it's kind of a traditional thing on shows that are not so much caller centric to go ahead and open up the lines on a Friday. That sounds good to me too. So, you guys will be able to call in and get involved on the show and talk about it. Now, as far as the Ebola thing, I think I'm just going to go ahead and say what I got to say and get through it, wrap it up here in the first segment, and then be done for the show. I never was really one for the salesmanship. I just, you know, I could talk about Ebola all week long like everybody else, I guess. But, nah. Anyway, so here's my thing about Ebola. Listen to Judith Miller. No, really. I saw Judith Miller for the young, for the new around here. You might not know. She was the number one worst reporter lying us into war from the New York Times in 2002 and 3. She was apparently Scooter Libby's girlfriend and the tiny little sock puppet of the neoconservative Gestapo office, as Colin Powell called it, inside the especially first Bush Jr. administration government there. Basically, she was a mole, an intelligence asset, not necessarily a CIA, but a Dick Cheney's office asset at the New York Times. And, you know, her co-author on all of those pieces, almost all of those horrible pieces, Michael Gordon, he's still telling lies at the New York Times right now. He's the guy who led the charge lying about Iran in 2007, that they were behind every roadside bomb exploding around there that almost led to strikes on Iran. He got to keep his job. She got thrown under the bus. Anyway, she's absolutely horrible. So I'm not apologizing for her. I'm just saying she became the, and deservedly, I guess if you had to have one scapegoat, she became the scapegoat for the rest of the media for getting Iraq wrong, as they virtually all did. But anyway, so Miller, Judith Miller, of all people, first of all, she's a Fox News analyst, expert, pundit, commentator. She didn't have to go and just get a job after this. She's fully rehabilitated now, not just at Newsmax, but on cable TV news all day. All right, it's still Fox, so all right. So they bring Judith Miller on to talk about Ebola. Well, actually, she wrote a book about germs. So she knows a little something about it. And here's what she says. Everybody relax. There's no Ebola epidemic in America. No American has died of it yet. And, you know, the Fox hairdo lady introduced the segment as, you know, is the media neglecting this story instead of doing enough to scare the hell out of everybody? And she's saying, no, you're doing too much to scare the hell out of everybody. And the flu is a lot greater danger. And, you know, everybody, you know, chill out a little bit. What the hell? And I'm with her. I mean, Ebola is scary if you get it. But come on. And yeah, I'm angry as hell at the these nurses who have been involved in any way in treating Ebola patients who then go and travel on airplanes and cruise ships. The lady on the cruise ship, I mean, they say she's got no symptoms, but I don't care. She's messing around with an Ebola patient. She gets on a cruise ship. She should have to walk the plank and drown. She is guilty, guilty, guilty of an attempted crime against all of humanity. The admiral, the captain of the cruise ship, ought to throw her ass overboard. Let the sharks get Ebola. And the lady that got on the plane to Ohio and then spent 3 days screwing around and then got on the plane back from Ohio to Dallas, I mean, she ought to be in prison for the rest of her life. That's however many tens of thousands of cases of attempted murder by her. And all this crap about she called the CDC and they gave her permission, well, they ought to be, you know, suffering the exact same punishment as her. But still, if you had Ebola, if you thought you might, you'd been treating someone with Ebola and you had a fever, you're going to outsource the decision about whether to take mass transit to the government? The worst people in the world? No, she's an adult. She's a healthcare professional. She's responsible. She should be taken out and shot. Anyway, that's the end of my Ebola thing. Don't be afraid of it, though. You're not going to get it. It's fine. Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. Darren's Coffee. Order now at darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and save $2. Darrenscoffee.com. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. And, well, this one is hilarious, so I'm going to talk about this one now. Israeli ministers slam Kerry for tying rise of Islamic State to Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Oh, I like stuff like this. It's really too bad that he didn't call John Kerry a Nazi and say, "All you bonesmen are Nazis," and then cause a real fight between, you know, Nazis and Israelis. I mean, Kerry's a Nazi to me. I don't know about you, but... Of course, John Kerry is absolutely right. That the entire region is in turmoil in great measure because of the unending occupation of Palestine. It's not just the existence of Israel, although that is problematic in itself. But it's their colonization of the West Bank, East Jerusalem, and the permanent siege of the Gaza Strip. That's what's driving everybody nuts. That's what's been driving everybody nuts for 50 years. 50 years. See, when they created the State of Israel, as evil as this is, I ain't apologizing for it, they ethnically cleansed the place until it was an 80% to 20% Jewish super-duper extra majority. Now, that's cruel as hell, and has led to a lot of problems, and a lot of people who live in the West Bank and Gaza are refugees, of course. I'm not saying any of that is right, but at least it makes sense that over a longer period of time, it would be, you know, like the whites taking over Massachusetts at some point. You know, whatever, the Indians got to get over the existence of Plymouth Plantation. Doesn't necessarily mean things got to escalate from there, although, bad example. But the point is, it's since 1988, it has been beyond dispute by the Palestinians that the State of Israel exists, and they recognize that. Yasser Arafat said he would recognize the existence of the State of Israel in 1988. In fact, he did recognize it in 1988. And said, well, let's work out a negotiation for a permanent peace from there, which means withdrawal of the colonists and the Israeli government from the occupied territory won in the 1967 war. And, you know, I'm sorry I'm always, for people who know about this, it's just ridiculous to sit here and listen to me tell the same story over and over again in such a simple way. But I am convicted that Americans don't understand. They don't know that there's an occupation. They just don't understand it. And if they understood that it's not just the existence of Israel, but it's Israel's colonization of the West Bank, East Jerusalem, the Gaza Strip, where the Palestinians still live, where they are the supermajority, but are under the rule of the Israeli police and military, then they would understand what the grievance is about. You know, this is why when Benjamin Netanyahu gave a speech in front of the United Nations last week, 2 weeks ago, 3 weeks ago, whatever it was, I guess 3 weeks ago, he just said, look, you know, Hebrew mythology says all of this land belongs to us. And yes, we will consider there being some kind of pseudo-Palestinian state at some point, but not because it belongs to you, but just because maybe we'll consider being nice someday once you're done capitulating completely, etc. They still have no right that he is bound to respect, according to himself, the Prime Minister of Israel. That's it. Jews born and raised in America why they have a right to return not just to Green Line Israel, but even to the West Bank. Quote unquote, return. Ironic quotes, return. And even be colonists in the West Bank. But the people of the West Bank, they don't have a right to it. So that's why they're always, oh, the peace process. Because the Israelis won't get out of the land that they're occupying and colonizing and go back to plain old Green Line Israel, the actual state of Israel, and leave the occupied territories. I think when Americans get their head around that, look at a map, think about it for a second, realize that, oh, geez, I guess they never really did explain that to me on Fox News before, huh? I wonder why not. At that point, it's possible to, you know, turn their mind around on the issue. A little bit of background. And it's not like it was the Palestinian refugees in the West Bank who launched the 67 war. It was the Israelis who started it anyway. And the Arab states that participated in it, still, it's not like that was the Palestinians' fault. They're all collectively guilty for 50 years. None of them have any rights that Israeli Jews are bound to respect for 50 years because the king of Jordan and the dictator of Egypt participated in an attack on Israel back in 1967. Doesn't make any sense. So John Kerry says, and I love this Haaretz article. They don't even get to the Kerry quote until two-thirds of the way through here or something. Well, half of the way through here. He says, as I went around and met, that's America's Secretary of State, failed presidential candidate, and Senate, former Senator John Kerry. As I went around and met with people, lost to George W. Bush after Bush had lied us into a war. What a pathetic loser. Sorry. He said, as I went around and met with people in the course of our discussions about the anti-Islamic State coalition, there wasn't a leader I met within the region who did not raise with me spontaneously the need to try to get peace between Israel and the Palestinians, because it was a cause of recruitment and of street anger and agitation that they felt. And I see a lot of heads nodding. They had to respond to. And people need to understand the connection of that. It has something to do with humiliation and denial and the absence of dignity. And Eid celebrates the opposite of all of that. So what we need to do, this is the Kerry quote. Well, I guess they did quote him at length, give him that. So what we need to do is recognize we need to build peace through specific partnerships. One partnership is specifically the effort to try to drive toward peace, to have a compromise, to find a way to create two states that can live together side by side, two peoples with both of their aspirations being respected. I still believe it's possible, and I still believe we need to work towards it. And see what he's saying here, just like Colin Powell, George W. Bush's Secretary of State, said before him, hey, man, just like David Petraeus said when he wasn't crawling on his belly before Max Boot, when he was caught representing the Pentagon's point of view, Israel's occupation is a threat to America's security interests here. Yes, it does help radicalize the entire region. Oh, and then, I'm sorry, I didn't get to the punchline. The punchline is Naftali Bennett says, it turns out that when a British Muslim decapitates a British Christian, there will always be someone to blame the Jew, pointing at John Kerry. So I hope they have a big fight about that rather than an apology. We'll see. Hey, all, Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. Kate and Iraq, bringing back the crucifixion, man. All right, guys. Somebody's going to kill these guys. Doesn't have to be us. They'll get killed. ISIS fighters crucify 17-year-old in Syria. 17-year-old boy. Fair enough. Headline writer. All right, yeah, so later on the show... God dang it. Later on the show, Gareth Porter on Iran, Jason Ditz on Libya, and Jonathan Landay on George W. Bush's torture regime. So that should be a lot of great fun. All right. So Cobain has not fallen. Oh, call-in number. You guys want to call in? It's Friday. I do calls. 512-271-4836. 512-271-4836.
Call in now. The Scott Horton Show. 512-271-4836.
A robot is standing by to take your call. Yeah. So, yeah, a couple of things here. I guess, first of all, Kurdish fighters, somebody, I guess, airdropped them some laser pointers or something, and they are helping to direct the fire of the American Air Force on the ground. And the Kurdish YPG fighters, which is the Syrian branch of the Kurdistan Workers Party, basically the PKK on the Syrian side of the line, they're claiming that they have driven ISIS out of much of the town. Certainly they've driven them back in some places. It's unclear, of course, just how far. The Turks have not done a damn thing this whole time still except sit there and sometimes turn refugees around and not let them in. I did see a clip on Fox News this morning of the Rear Admiral spokesman for the Pentagon, Kirby, saying that, no, it still might fall, I don't know. They're not at all taking responsibility for guaranteeing that Kobani does not fall. They refuse to do so. I guess it is within the realm of possibility, if they have a strong enough militia force on the ground directing air power, that that could be pretty effective, and maybe they could get the Islamic State to change their mind and withdraw. They lose too many guys for too little effort and too little chance of getting the job the rest of the way done. It'd be nice to see them losing somewhere for a little while. Although I certainly oppose any and all American intervention. I have to say that I also, like all of you, think it would be really fun to fly an F-16. And I know that everybody, I mean, well, I don't know everybody. I know many, many, many people, and including many of my favorite writers, they just cannot stand to write about this war without including a recommendation for what should be done. You know, I read, these are far from my favorite writers, but I read an op-ed by the New York Times that was absolutely great on this war, and then ended with, we better be prepared to do something about this. What are we going to do? We're going to have to intervene more at the end. Are you kidding me? After all of what you just got right, you're going to say we ought to do something? What are you, mad? And then over at The Intercept, our friend Murtaza Hussein had a great article. I forget what it was about. It was some aspect of the war. And it was really good. Oh, it was about how everybody's on the terrorist list. Everybody's on the terrorist list. This side and that side, and the Kurds and the Turks and the ISIS and the Nusra and the Assad and Hezbollah and everybody too. So what the hell are you going to do? But then at the end he says, you're going to have to revisit this if you're going to be able to decide what should be done about these problems, whatever, whatever. Is it really? It's like, it's so just trendy and fit any or whatever right now that everyone just has to say something has to happen. Something must be done by the U.S. government about this problem. And I don't know what's the motive. Maybe they really just want to fly an F-16 and go strafe these bastards themselves. I understand. Maybe only some kook would say, absolutely no intervention at all. Ron Paul, 08. Stay the hell out of Syria and Iraq altogether forever. I don't care if Baghdadi is replaced by Zawahiri himself in some fancy Al-Qaeda coup d'etat. No more war over there. People just can't say it. And, you know, whatever. I could go on naming names. My job now, even though I got laid off from antiwar.com, I still sort of kind of work there. And my job, really, I got Matt's job. I decide what viewpoints run on the page in the viewpoints section. What gets the spotlight and what gets run and what gets thrown in the trash. And a lot of great writing, a lot of really great writing is being thrown in the trash. Because it says at the end, and that's why we have to ally with Assad. No! And that's why we have to, you know, really, really work hard at encouraging Abadi to forge alliances with the Sunni sheiks. No! Just leave it! Just leave it! And, you know, look, hey, what can I say, man? The U.S. military is the most powerful force of fire and destruction that has ever existed. Will ever exist, probably. Maybe the end of us all. So it makes sense. If I could fly an F-16, I would strafe the crap out of the Islamic State till they were all strafed to death. See them pictures of them all lined up down the highway like that? Doesn't that look like fun? That looks like a highway of death that you wouldn't have to feel guilty about. When George H.W. Bush massacred the highway of death, they were all just retreating conscripts, man. Have mercy, George H.W. Bush, you sick bastard. No, kill them all. Bury them alive in their trenches by the tens of thousands. No, really, read about it. Buried them alive. 1991, as they were attempting to retreat from Kuwait. And anyway, so, but ISIS? Strafe ISIS? I don't mind. Does anybody feel bad about that? These guys who shoot a little kid in the face for saying, hey man, I won't even give a discount to Mohammed if he came to buy some fruit from my fruit stand. Or maybe that was the Al-Nusra Front, the moderates. Is that nice? I think that was nice. They crucify people to death. They cut people's heads off. They go look on LiveLeak and you can see footage of ISIS massacring hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of men. Just laying them all down. How many men could you fit on a basketball court? Or say half of a basketball court. I don't know. And then just machine gun them all to death with AK-47s. And those aren't all, you know, soldiers. They're just Shia. Some of the times. And still, massacring a bunch of prisoner soldiers isn't okay either, but... you know, in Syria, there was a Sunni tribe that resisted them, and 700 of them were lined up and shot. Or laid down and shot, I guess. Anyway. But that's alright. Not anyway. That's okay, because that... Not, it's okay, but it's... the point is... That's one of the main reasons we do not have to intervene here. Intervening will create a lot of adverse consequences. But these guys are going to burn themselves out and wear out their welcome with these millions of Sunni people and their population they've conquered very quickly, just like they did back in 06 and 07. So just wait. Sorry. Hey, Al Scott here for MyHeroesThink.com. They sell beautiful 7-inch busts of libertarian heroes, Ludwig von Mises, Murray Rothbard, Ron Paul, and Harry Brown. These finely crafted statues from MyHeroesThink.com make excellent decorations for your desktop at work, bookends for your shelves, or gifts for that special individualist in your life. They're also all available in colors now, too. Of course, gold, silver, or bronze. Coming soon, Hayek, Hazlitt, Carlin. Use promo code Scott Horton and save $5 at MyHeroesThink.com. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show here, man. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show. It's libertarian foreign policy, mostly. That's as close as I can get to having a tagline, because I just don't like the self-promotionalism. But that is what this show is. It's libertarian foreign policy. And in the chat room, it was being wondered, it was being wondered in the chat room whether Tom Woods is 100% solid on this war. And it was not, there was no suspicion, it was just an open question, I believe the way it was asked, there was no implication, just don't know. Does anyone know? And the answer is, Tom Woods is as good as war as, no, he's way better than war. He's as good on war as I am. So, if I'm anti-war enough for you, I sure hope I am, then Tom Woods is too. And here's how I can actually scientifically and quantitatively prove that. Some of you may know already, Tom Woods and I are writing a book about ending this war. And I plan on taking some time and really getting to it and knocking this thing out. I will tell you one thing about the book. I sat down and wrote the outline for it in about an hour and a half. And that includes all the going back and thinking of new stuff and editing a little and copy and pasting here and there. I mean, as far as actually drawing out the outline and call it 90% done, it took me 15 minutes. 10. I know exactly what I want to write. I know exactly in what order I want to write it. I know exactly what sources I have for my footnotes and exactly what more I need to read in order to get it right. And I'm ready to finally write a goddamn book. And then the good part is Tom's going to rewrite it and make it good. So, you know, Tom actually has talent. I just know stuff. So we're going to combine, know some stuff about this with talent for writing. And we're going to put out the best damn libertarian anti-war book anybody could ever put out about this goddamn war on terror. How about that? That's the plan. That's the plan. I'm writing a book. So, there you go. Isn't that cool? I saw somebody tweeted out, wow, Tom, that's great. So I think, you know, Cat's already out of the bag. He mentioned it the other day. So, yeah, and you guys better buy some. I don't know how long it's going to take, but honestly, well, what I need is some time. So, I mean, I don't know. Maybe, I'll take off the whole week of Thanksgiving and just work solid 7 days. Tell the wife to take care of everything or dang self and just lock myself in this office, turn off Twitter, and type until my fingers break. I really want to make progress on it. Got to get started now. And boy, when Tom Woods tweets out or says on his show that this is happening, it's like Stand By Me where he takes his friend's hat and throws it over the fence. Yep, we got to climb over into the junkyard now because what are you going to do? Lose your hat? You can't lose your hat, man. Throw your hat over the fence. Now you have to get it done. So there you go. That's what I'm doing right now, too. Hey, everybody, I'm writing a book. Now what am I going to do? Fail to write a book? Can't do that or else you guys are all pointing laugh at me and I couldn't have that. All right, good. So there's that news. So, yeah. Tom Woods is as good as me on war, which is all the way good. All right, so, and yes, JDA, you may have an autographed copy, absolutely. We're going to do something about that. All right. Now, someone said, I think you meant Kobani. What did I say? Was it just that I pronounced it wrong? Or what did I say? Irrible? when I meant Kobani, I don't know what happened. Did I say British Columbia when I meant Kobani? I don't think so. I said Cobain. Yeah, sorry. I don't know. All right. Sorry, I got a computer technical difficulty that I'm screwing up over here. Not your fault. Yeah, Kobani is how it's pronounced. I just wasn't thinking when I was talking. But yeah, these things happen. So now, but somebody wrote, it's fallen. You don't know what you're talking about, dude. Am I right about that? Is that what you said? Let me go refresh antiwar.com. Let me go put Kobani in Google News right now. I see Al-Qaeda overruns town in Yemen. Yeah, we got to get back to that, man. I've been promising you guys Yemen news all week. I mentioned a little bit Al-Qaeda versus the Houthis there. Kobani in Google News this very moment, and it says it may fall, according to militants. 600 killed. Why it matters. Arms falling. You got a link there? Someone say that you know it fell already? Did I read that right? Now, here's another thing. As long as we're talking about Kobani, I tried to get him on the show. It'd be kind of a fun thing for a change to talk to Andrew Coburn, Patrick's brother, about this great article he wrote, Flying Blind, U.S. Air Power. Oh, the U.S. Air Power Lobby, Botched Bombing Missions, and Bootless Combat. And, man, good old Andrew Coburn, dude. He's great. This is at Harper's.org, Harper's Magazine. Flying Blind, Andrew Coburn. In fact, I better make sure and send this to Garrus so that we can run this as a viewpoint. I think we want to run it. Well, I don't know if it's really anti-war. Yeah, sure it is. We'll run it on antiwar.com. So here's the thing. Here's what it's about. And he wrote about this before. If you want a plane that's good for flying slow and low and killing guys on the ground, the bad guys, quote unquote, and not killing your own guys, what you do is you send in A-10 Warthogs. I used to have a toy G.I. Joe one in the 1980s when I was a boy. And the thing about them is the pilot sits in a titanium bathtub, as they call it, and the thing is heavily armored, and it flies low and slow, and you can blow part of the wing off, and it won't crash, and it's a badass plane for killing tanks. It's a badass plane for when American Army or Marines are tied down, and they need air support, but they're close, they've been ambushed, and they would also like to not get blown away by their air power protectors. You send in the A-10s. And yet, Andrew Coburn puts this perfectly. And this is so important for people to understand. You know, you hear this, oh, Army pukes and whatever. I don't know all their nicknames for each other. But all the different services, they're trained to hate each other, mostly because they're trained to think of themselves as so exclusive, etc. Now, I don't know if I can find the exact phrase in here. I should have figured out a way to highlight. I think he says it right at the beginning here about how the Air Force hates this job. Here it is. Close air support. Close air support, as it's called, has always been considered a lowly and demeaning task by the Air Force, since it involved cooperation with ground troops, right? This is how, military jargon completely clouds the issue of who's on whose side here, man. If U.S. Army are bogged down, maybe getting killed by Taliban or whoever, for the Air Force to have the job of saving their lives is the equivalent of janitorial work, the equivalent of, septic tank repair. No offense to you guys, I'm just saying from their point of view. And so they don't want to fly A-10s. They've been trying to get out of the job of flying A-10s all along. And I don't know why the Army just doesn't have their own damn fleet of A-10s, for Christ's sake. I guess the Air Force would freak about that, too. But so this article, again, Andrew Coburn at The Independent, author of Rumsfeld, His Rise, Fall, and Catastrophic Legacy. Here he is at Harper's.org writing about flying blind in a B-1. Did you see my tweet? Did you see on CNN when they had local news footage there in Kobani of B-1 bombers flying overhead, hitting these ISIS targets? And, of course, doing a terrible job because they're designed for delivering H-bombs to Moscow at Mach 2. They're not suited to this job, and he tells a story of Americans killed by friendly fire in Afghanistan. Read it. It's great. It's horrible. Andrew Coburn at Harper's.
Hey, Al Scott here for MyHeroesThink.com. They sell beautiful 7-inch busts of libertarian heroes Ludwig von Mises, Murray Rothbard, Ron Paul, and Harry Brown. These finely crafted statues from MyHeroesThink.com make excellent decorations for your desktop at work, bookends for your shelves, or gifts for that special individualist in your life. They're also all available in colors now, too. Of course, gold, silver, or bronze. Coming soon, Hayek, Hazlitt, Carlin. Use promo code Scott Horton and save $5 at MyHeroesThink.com.
All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Our first guest today is the great Gareth Porter, independent historian and journalist, author of the book Manufactured Crisis, writer for Interpress Service, as well as truthout.org, where he's won awards for his work on the war in Afghanistan. And here he's got a brand new one at foreignpolicy.com. And for whatever reason, they'll let you pass the paywall for this one. It's a big one and exclusive. And I think maybe Gareth's first at foreignpolicy.com. But I can certainly see why they, took it up here. When the Ayatollah said no to nukes. Welcome back to the show, Gareth. How are you doing?
I'm good. Thanks, Scott. Thanks for having me again.
Very happy to have you here. So, wow, this isn't even about this Ayatollah. This is about the mean old Ayatollah Khomeini, twice as bad as Khomeini, right?
Well, that's right. I mean, Khomeini was the one who really played an extremely central key role in establishing the fundamental position of the Islamic Republic of Iran on weapons of mass destruction. And that's really what this story for foreign policy is all about.
And now you went to Iran, and now they're publishing your book in Farsi over there, right? Which is great.
Exactly. Yes, that was one of the things that I did while I was in Tehran last month and into this month. For about a week or so, I did have the launch for the Farsi edition of my book. I did some interviews. I had several very interesting interviews and was also participating at least for a few minutes in this very rather strange conference that you may or may not have read about it. I'm not sure. As a result of which I have now been targeted by the 9/11 truth movement as an enemy and a presumed Zionist agent or something of that sort.
Because of what now? Oh, you disagreed with the truthers at the thing, yeah.
Truthers, one article that I just seen this morning recalled a conversation that had been taking place in the back seat of a car coming from the old U.S. Embassy in Tehran. I was sitting next to one of the leaders of this movement and hearing his argument, and I wasn't buying it, and So it didn't end well.
Yeah, well, those things don't. But anyway, I saw you on the other side, smeared by Rosie Gray over at BuzzFeed for participating in a thing that would include people like that at all. And they went on and on with their guilt by association, which I thought was really hilarious. And I defended you on Twitter, where it really matters, Gareth. So but anyway, let's talk about this awesome journalism that you've done, because while you were in Iran, you interviewed at length in his office the former head of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, and you learned some things. Is that right?
Well, he was not head of the Revolutionary Guard Corps. He was the minister of SEPA, which is the Minister of Revolutionary Guards. And that's a slightly different position, but he was a very key person with regard to supply of weapons for the war against Iraq, for the Iran-Iraq war.
Okay, so rewind everybody back to the Reagan years when George W. Bush's father was the vice president and Saddam Hussein worked for us against Iran because they'd overthrown America's sock puppet dictator in 1979. Sorry, go ahead.
Yeah, so this was a very interesting interview, as I knew it would be, by somebody who had actually met with Khomeini on two occasions. He may have met with him on other occasions as well, but there were two occasions which were crucial to understanding the wartime policy of Iran on the question of chemical weapons, first of all, because, of course, this issue arose because the Iraqi forces began to use chemical weapons to attack Iranian forces as early as 1982 or 1983. And then a little later in the war, actually began to use them against civilian targets inside Iran. And so as a result of the Iraqi use of chemical weapons against the Iranians, the Ministry of SEPA, the head of Ministry of SEPA, his name is Mohsen Rafik Dust, of course, he's now retired from the government, and I met him in his office of the foundation. And he recalled how he had prepared a report for Ayatollah Khomeini, then supreme leader of Iran. He prepared a report in which he had organized groups of specialists on different kinds of military needs that Iran had for its war against Iraq. And one of the groups that he had organized, young specialists with various technical expertise, was, as he put it, chemical, biological, and nuclear. And so he went to see Khomeini to ask his reaction to this list of special groups. But particularly, of course, he was interested in that particular group because he wanted to do something to respond to the Iraqi use of chemical weapons. And what happened in that meeting, as he relayed it to me, was, first of all, that Khomeini said, "What's this?" when he saw this mention of the chemical, biological, nuclear group. And so Rafik Dust explained his plan to have this group work on various kinds of weapons that might be needed against Iraq. And the first thing he said was, "Well, forget about nuclear weapons. We're not gonna do nuclear weapons. That's forbidden by Islam." And as for the chemical weapons, he said, "No, you can work on defensive means to defend against the use of these weapons by Iraq." Meaning to have sort of gas masks and other things that would detect the use of the weapons and give some protection against the weapons, but not chemical weapons. So that was a key decision by Khomeini, and he based it again on Islamic doctrine, Islamic jurisprudence, or Shia jurisprudence, saying that it was not consistent with Islam. So So then time passed, and in 1987, the Iraqis used chemical weapons against the civilian targets in a place called Sardasht, in a city of some 10,000 people, as I recall, named Sardasht. And at that point, then, he went into action again, and this time he went further. He actually got the precursor chemicals for the chemical weapon mustard gas, and actually set up a facility with which to manufacture the weapons. And at that point, then he went back to meet with Ayatollah Khomeini to ask him whether he would approve the manufacture of chemical weapons. And in that second meeting, then Khomeini again said, "This is haram. This is forbidden by Islam. You cannot do it." And that was the end of the work on chemical weapons. They were never weaponized, and this was recorded in a document later on, which it was made public in a WikiLeaks cable, diplomatic cable, that reproduced the entire document that Iran had passed on to the United States government in 2004.
All right. Well, I'm sorry. We got to stop there. When we get back, follow-up questions with our hero, the great Gareth Porter. He's got the top story today, exclusive, at foreignpolicy.com, when the Ayatollah said no to nukes. Huge. It's the spotlight today on antiwar.com. We'll be right back. Hey, all, Scott Horton here. I want to tell you about this great new book, Livin' La Vida Baroka, American Culture in an Age of Imperial Orthodoxies by Thomas Harrington. While he comes from the left, Harrington has little time for much of what is passed off under that label today. Like us libertarians, he puts peace and freedom first. The book's got great essays on American fascism, empire, the Israeli occupation, the left and Obama, liberalism and the state, and some interesting lessons from the history of Imperial Spain. Livin' La Vida Baroka by Thomas Harrington. Check it out at scotthorton.org/books or scotthorton.org/Amazon. All right, guys, welcome back to the thing here, man. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. scotthorton.org/interviews for 3,500 interviews going back about 11 and a half years or so there. Talking with Gareth Porter. He's the author of the book, Manufactured Crisis, The Untold Story of the Iran Nuclear Scare, where, boy, oh boy, does he debunk every last bit of reason to believe that they were ever making nukes over there. No doubt about it. Read that book, Manufactured Crisis. You can get it at justworldbooks.com or at amazon.com, of course. And now, as far as I know, Gareth, the latest in-depth and I think the best study of America's support for Saddam Hussein's use of chemical weapons in the war against Iran is also at foreignpolicy.com. It's written, I think, a year ago by Matthew Aid and Shane Harris, and it's called CIA Files Prove America Helped Saddam as He Gassed Iran. And for people unfamiliar, these guys have real fact checkers. This is no, this isn't even antiwar.com. This is Foreign Policy. It's published by the Washington Post, and they don't publish articles like that, ain't fact checked. And Matthew Aid and Shane Harris, if you've never heard of them, are both very mainstream, incredible, acceptable reporters. This is not any sort of alternative media. Not to indict alternative media, just that some people like to dismiss things that don't come from the Washington Post. And I'm just saying that, yeah, Aid and Harris and now Gareth are here published at foreignpolicy.com. And Gareth's story is about the Iranian side of things. He just got back from Iran, where he interviewed one of the leaders of the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps there, who, when America was helping Saddam target Iran with those chemical weapons, he went to the Ayatollah twice and said, let me please use chemical weapons and or nuclear weapons, and was told no. And this is by the Ayatollah Khomeini, not Khomeini, but Khomeini, the one who was involved in the coup back in 79 that people think of as the great Satan himself or whatever, for thwarting American will and embarrassing America so badly with the hostage crisis and all back then. But anyway, so I want to make sure I understand this right. I believe what you said, Gareth, and I'm sorry I didn't get a chance to reread it this morning. I read it last night, but I think what you said was the first time he brought up nukes, too, and the Ayatollah said, forget it. And the second time he went back to him, he was really only asking about chemicals, although, as you say, he had already gotten some of the precursors together and was really hoping for a green light here. But he didn't even really try nukes at that point, or did he? He brought up nukes again at that point, and the Ayatollah told him no again.
My recollection is that that the nuclear issue was not on the table in this conversation. Maybe I've forgotten that he may have raised it, or Khomeini may have said something in this conversation as well. That was also off the table. But anyway, in 1987, late 87, which is when I date this second meeting with Khomeini. The primary purpose of it was clearly to try to get Khomeini's okay to go ahead and actually weaponize, to produce mustard gas in order to respond to the Iraqi attacks on Iranian civilians.
And I think you say here that he cited as reasons to say no to chemicals and nuclear weapons that he cited religious reasons, that this is haram, you can't do it. But he also even cited the relationship with the United States And are we going to have a bad relationship with America forever, for 1,000 years, something like that? He says here. Knew that if they embarked on a chemical weapons program, that that would just be making matters worse as far as any possible rapprochement with us. He really cited that, huh?
That's right. I mean, this was not necessarily something that was said in that same meeting. In fact, I don't think it was probably at that meeting that he stated that. It would have been soon after the revolution, when Rafik Dost was looking for a place for headquarters for the Revolutionary Guard, and that's when Khomeini said to him, why go there? Why should we do we expect to be have a hostile relationship with the United States for 1,000 years? Just don't go there. And so that was an indication of Khomeini's pragmatism, even at the very beginning of the Islamic Republic of Iran. You still there? Hello?
Oh, sorry, Gareth. So the conservative argument here is going to be, yeah, right, politicians say lots of things, and theocrats even more, but that doesn't mean that it's true, and so why should we believe some fatwa is actually legitimate rather than just the cover story?
Yeah, and of course, the reason that we should believe this fatwa was real and effective is precisely the fact that Iran did not go ahead and weaponize the precursor chemicals for mustard gas, which clearly they could have easily done to retaliate against the Iraqi chemical weapons, or even to say, okay, we now have the chemical weapons, Iraq, you cease and desist, or we will strike back. They didn't do either one of those things. And in fact, till the very end of the war, Iran was unable to essentially pose even a threat of use of chemical weapons against Iraq. Now, that is a situation which cannot be explained in any other way, and has never been explained in any other way, than the effectiveness of the fatwa by Khomeini. And to me, that is a very convincing argument that it was indeed Islamic jurisprudence that determined Iran's policy toward weapons of mass destruction during that war.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I'm sorry, I got instant message going on over here distracting the hell out of me, Gareth. What was my awesome question going to be? Oh, yeah, you talked about in the article the difference between a religious fatwa about, you know, how you should pursue your courtship or whatever, as opposed to the supreme leader of the Islamic Republic issuing an actual religious edict over the political government. Talk about that really fast.
Exactly. That's an extremely important point. I'm glad you've raised it, Scott. There's such a lot of nonsense that has been published about the question of fatwas, where people argue, oh, look, all these ayatollahs have put out many fatwas where they change their mind later on, or they just put out obvious nonsense, and therefore fatwas are not to be taken seriously. Well, I'm sure that's true. I mean, there are plenty of fatwas that are not worth anything, and which are only, in fact, binding even in the theory of Islamic legal practice. They're only binding on those people who choose to follow that ayatollah. But in the case of the supreme leader of the Islamic Republic, which, of course, is a unique institution, a unique situation, the supreme leader's fatwas on matters of government policy are binding on the entire government. They have a status which is higher than legislation in the Islamic Republic. So that's a very different situation. And all those arguments that have been put forward for paying no attention to fatwas simply don't apply in that situation.
Yeah. So it's like the whim of an American president. They can just do whatever they want. It's the highest law of the land. Gotcha. All right. I'm sorry. We're out of time. Thank you so much. Congratulations on your great scoop. I'm looking forward to the rest of them soon to come. Gareth Porter at foreignpolicy.com today, when the Ayatollah said no to nukes. Thanks, Gareth.
Thanks very much, Scott.
Hey, y'all. Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop. Which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, Scott Horton Show. Next up on the show, it's our friend Jason Ditz back on the line. This time, at least for starters, we got to talk about Libya. Welcome back to the show, Jason. How are you doing?
I'm doing good, Scott. How are you?
I'm doing real good. Appreciate you joining us today. And, yeah, man, so I was explaining to the people at the top of the show there that if they go to news.antiwar.com, they'll know pretty much everything they need to know about what the hell is going on in the world. All day, every day, you're writing it up over there. And I don't know what we'd do without you. And I don't know what I'd do without you to talk to me about Libya on the show. There are very few reporters and even many fewer opinion columnists paying any attention to this, trying to, you know, compile the news together and give us a good narrative about what the hell is even going on over there these days. And I was just thinking as I hit the button that, you know, I think you and I did a lot of coverage of the Libya war back in 2011 because there was that same kind of dearth of coverage back then. We need, you know, Jason to do the summary because of the actual reporters on the ground. There are only, you know, two or three or four to choose from. So we run out of those pretty quick. Thank God you're there and paying attention. So is it even fair to call the country Libya anymore? Or is it the country formerly known as Libya? Are they going back to calling it Tripolitania or whatever the hell?
Yeah, I think calling it Libya hasn't really been true for a few years now. Even post-Gaddafi, you know, with the installation of that provisional government, they never really controlled more than a couple of cities at any given time. And now it's at the point where they're holed up in a hotel along the Tunisian border, the parliament, and that's basically all the territory they hold.
Really? And so, and now there's already another parliament. Is that in Benghazi too? Or wait, one is near Tripoli and the other is near Benghazi, something like that, is that it?
Right.
And then, so the one in Benghazi, is that the more Islamist? And the one in Tripoli, the one in the hotel, that sounds like it must be the CIA, General Haftar coup d'etat government there, huh?
Right. And they're not even near Tripoli anymore. They're more along the Tunisian border.
Yep. Well, hang on a goddamn minute, man. Let me pull up my map here. I guess Tripoli's in the west, but it's not that far to the west. Is that what you're saying? Or Tunisia is completely on the other side of the country from where I'm thinking.
No, it's further along the coast, though. It's in Zawara.
I got you.
Which is just like a little coastal town.
Oh, I see. Yeah, oh, okay. Tripoli's what, like maybe 400 or 500 miles east of the border there, huh?
Right.
I see. All right. I need a better picture of North Africa in my brain so I don't have to Google it all the time while you're talking to me here. yeah, Tunisia's that tiny little state wedged in there between Algeria and Libya in the north there. I was thinking for a minute, well, wait, they're not further east of Benghazi. No. All right. Sorry. Yeah, so point being, well, now, wait a minute. Doesn't General Haftar have the support of the CIA, and doesn't that imply money to buy militiamen and weapons to shoot at their enemies? Is that even really happening at this point? Is it completely ineffective?
Well, he has the support of the Egyptian junta, but his claims of support from the CIA haven't really amounted to much so far. I mean, he keeps insisting that's the case, and it certainly was the case 10, 20 years ago, but it's not really clear how much the U.S. is still in bed with him anymore.
Hmm. Yeah, it's funny because it's interesting you say that he keeps claiming it. That makes it sound like it's really not true. He just wishes it was. I mean, it's kind of the obvious thing, right, that after a few years, they realized, oops, we supported the Mujahideen against the guy with the clean-shaven chin, so that was a mistake, so let's try to hire the next Gaddafi and see if he can be a new, you know, a General Sisi, a secular military dictator over the country, to try to, you know, make up for their terrible mistake.
But no, they're not even trying. This guy's just winging it himself, you think?
Well, it's not really clear right now. I mean, certainly Egypt's putting a lot of weight behind him, launching airstrikes on his behalf around Benghazi. But the U.S. so far seems to be sort of on the sidelines, at least for the obvious direct aid.
Yeah, that's interesting. I wonder why they're not backing him. I guess, you know, maybe he's a real Chalabi type and they don't like him. He's too interested in himself or some kind of thing. Do we know very much about him, really? Other than he lived in Virginia for a long time?
Well, right. He was a Gaddafi general. He got captured during one of Gaddafi's ill-conceived operations over in neighboring countries. The U.S. more or less negotiated his release on the idea that he'd be an inside man. Gaddafi disavowed him almost immediately, and he ended up living in first he was living along the frontier of Libya in other countries, sort of managing a CIA-backed rebel force. That never really amounted to much, though, and he eventually ended up in Virginia.
And then, so, they parachuted him in not even till 2012, right? Till after the war was over?
Right.
And he parachuted himself in, maybe.
Yeah, he sort of announced that he was going to be the new leader of the Libyan military, and he left and went to Libya. And he never really got any formal position in the Libyan military. They gave him some sort of token, you know, advisory position.
Hey, man, are the cops flying a helicopter out your window?
No, it's a lawnmower.
Oh, okay, that's all right. Nothing you can do about that.
Now,
I was just wondering, why don't you go outside and shake your fist at that helicopter and tell him to fly away? All right, well, anyway. Yeah, so, yeah, I guess if they're holed up in a hotel, so much for that. It's already over before it began, huh? And then, so what does that mean? That means, I guess, whatever warring factions in Benghazi are still fighting over the east, but what are the west? Does anybody control Tripoli, or it's just criminal gangs running around, or who the hell's in charge in the former capital?
The militia out of Misrata actually controls most of Tripoli now. The Misrata militia was surprisingly strong during the anti-Gaddafi war, and primarily were noted for completely exterminating the town of Africans just south of them, just completely wiping it out, chasing everyone into refugee camps in Tripoli, then attacking the refugee camps in Tripoli. And now they control basically that little strip between Misrata and Tripoli. They control most of the capital.
And by the way, whatever happened to all that ethnic cleansing, too? Again, back to how there's so little reporting out of Libya. I mean, there was no... I never heard of anybody stopping it, but it seemed like the Libyan KKK was running around over there doing whatever they felt like.
Right, and it never really stopped, although sort of like what happened in Iraq during, just before the surge in Iraq, there had been enough ethnic cleansing to the point where there weren't a lot of ethnicities living near each other anymore, so there wasn't really a lot of high-profile incidents anymore.
All right. Well, there's a sad place to leave it. But yeah, man, people go back and read David Enders on some of the anti-black pogroms in Libya. I think it probably makes Barack Obama the most racist president since Woodrow Wilson. Anyway, we'll be right back with more with the great Jason Ditz, news.antiwar.com, right after this. Hey, Al Scott here for Whole Food Multicomplete at WholeFoodComplete.com. Whole Food Multicomplete is an entire supplement program in one bottle, containing 100% RDA of vitamins and minerals, plus live probiotics, digestive enzymes, antioxidant herbs, energy nutrients, and more. It's made in America using real foods and live probiotics, no chemical synthetics. It's soy-free, gluten-free, and independently tested and verified. They're so sure you'll love it, they're taking 20% off your first order with coupon code Scott Horton. Satisfaction is guaranteed at WholeFoodComplete.com. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. And yes, archive podcast listeners, the reason for the dead airspace there is because there's bumper music playing that the live audience hears that you don't hear. That's why it sounds like there are naturally long pauses in my welcome backs from the breaks. Makes sense now, doesn't it? Just there was The Wizard by Black Sabbath, but you couldn't hear it. But they could. All right. Speaking of live and what's actually happening right now, I'm in the middle of a conversation with Jason Ditz. News.antiwar.com. You want to know the latest on what all is going on everywhere where there's something important going on that you need to know about? You go to news.antiwar.com. He's keeping track of it for you. Really. I couldn't overstate it. News.antiwar.com. All right. Now, Jason, could you please talk to me a bit about what is going on over in Eastern, formerly known as Libya? Was it Syrencia? Is that what it used to be called back before World War II? I don't know how to pronounce these things. Do you?
I'm not sure. I'd always heard it Cyrenaica.
See, yeah, you're 1,000 times closer than me. I know that for a fact right there. Okay, good. So call it Jihadistan. What's going on there in Benghazi? Benghazi, it's not just a word for provoking knee-jerk reactions out of conservatives. It's actually a place with people in it and things that happen there. It's also the fake casus belli that was the excuse for this war in the first place. But anyway, update us on what's going on in Benghazi right now.
Well, Benghazi, of course, was the birthplace of the anti-Gaddafi revolution. And after the end of that revolution and the installation of the provisional government, there was a lot of annoyance that the people that led the revolution against Gaddafi didn't get a lot of the important positions of power in the new government. A lot of them were just, you know, sort of early on Gaddafi defectors. And a lot of the complaints that they had about oil revenue sharing and things like that are still just as true as they ever were. So there was still a lot of unrest there. And eventually, there have been several factions that have tried to set up their own separate governments in Benghazi. The Shura Council is the most effective of those groups and controls virtually the whole city at this point. They're one of the more Islamist groups. Ansar al-Sharia is a member of their council. And they've been fighting against General Haftar, and the portions of the Libyan military that he managed to recruit to his cause.
Now, whatever happened to the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group? Do you know? They get folded into something else?
I'm honestly not sure anymore. So many of these groups come and go so quickly.
That was a pretty major one from, well, as major as they got anyway, right? From the war in 2011?
Right.
But, yeah, I guess, I don't know who to talk to about that. Maybe Mel Freichberg knows.
Yeah, everything just sort of split off.
It's the same difference as Ansar al-Sharia anyway, right?
Right. Everything just sort of split off into its various city-based militias. That's basically the story across Libya, is like the Misrata militia. Ansar al-Sharia is virtually confined to Benghazi, as are the other militias there. You've basically got these one-city militias that are trying to extend their control over neighboring towns. There is no central authority in Libya anymore, and there hasn't been for some time.
Yeah. Well, I wonder, you know, if it used to be three states, I wonder if it'll be six now, or if there will ever be states. It'll just be Westphalia is over, and it's fourth generation low-level war there from now on. Although, somebody's going to come in and clamp down in the name of the oil at some point, right? Or I guess the oil is kind of so far out in the middle of nowhere, it doesn't matter either way.
Well, that's the other difficult thing, is that a lot of the oil really is just out in the desert. So control over the towns doesn't necessarily mean control over the oil. And it's really been a disaster for the Western oil companies that were supposed to be making all this money over the freed up Libyan oil after Gaddafi's era ended. The Italian oil giant pumped just a ton of money into getting the rights to most of Libya's oil, and production has been intermittent. Sometimes it stops entirely for weeks at a time. It's just been a disaster.
Yeah. Well, you know, back then, when we covered this war in 2011, I was always predicting that it'd be just like Iraq after Tripoli falls. It was so obvious then, and for 9 months it took to finally get rid of the guy. And it was obvious all along that, wow, once he goes, his whole government goes with him, and it's going to be replaced by chaos. And so who's going to build a new government, right? It's going to be the U.S. is going to invade. They're going to send however many thousand troops, train up a new army, and purple-fingered elections, which I guess they did do the purple finger thing there for a minute. But anyway, they never did do that, right? Like, they sent in some trainers, but they turn around and left because, man, this sucks. Let's get the hell out of here. And so I'm thankful for that, but I'm worried that at some point the U.S., the indispensable nation, is going to take it as, you know, probably even Obama will take it as his, or Hillary will take it as their responsibility to try to reform this nation. I mean, Lord knows they got more than enough on their plate and they can't accomplish any of it. But still, I just can't imagine they're going to leave the middle part of North Africa on fire indefinitely, you know? They're going to hire one guy to have a monopoly on killing people there, like in Egypt and like Iraq used to be.
Yeah, it seems like sooner or later that's going to happen, and I'm amazed it hasn't happened so far. Right now it seems like the U.S. is content to just every once in a while launch an arrest raid against somebody in Libya, kidnap somebody off the coast and drag him off on a ship and say, well, he was something to do with the consulate attack, and that's about it.
Yeah, well, so thank goodness for that. I mean, I don't mean to be giving them ideas, and I sure don't support it, but I admit I am amazed. I guess I did not give Iraq War Syndrome enough credit for people really hate this stuff, and in D.C., they get it, that they kind of can't do that anymore without making us all really, really hate them for it. And of course, if they really did put in a large number of troops there to accomplish anti-terrorism and army training and everything, they would just create an entire new army of suicide bombers against them and justify, you know, they could, if they wanted to escalate and escalate, they could have an entire Iraq war-sized war over there pretty close for a while. So, thank goodness they're not doing it, but it does, I guess, still seem a matter of it being inevitable. Unless they are able to give enough billions to a guy like Haftar for him to be able to pull it off. But I guess he just doesn't have their confidence. And I guess nobody does either.
Yeah, that's the thing. It's not clear who you back at this point. Certainly Egypt's throwing its weight behind Haftar. And obviously they just see that as a chance to install a similar military dictatorship along their border. Mm-hmm.
And the Americans support that effort of the Egyptians then, right?
Oh, certainly. I mean, publicly they would never say it, but I don't think there's any doubt that they're fine with that.
Yeah. Well, it doesn't seem to be working or anything like that. And now, when Egypt sent in warplanes a month and a half ago or so, they brought who? The Qataris with them?
I think it was
because the Qataris were the pro-Muslim Brotherhood.
Right, I think it was the United Arab Emirates.
Oh, right. Yeah, see, I got to keep these things straight in my head about who's on whose side. It's hard.
They denied involvement, so Egypt never denied involvement, but the UAE did. So it's not really clear how involved they were.
And by the way, you know, speaking of all this presumed chaos, can you be specific at all? Do you have any kind of idea of maybe how many different militias, how many people have been killed in fighting in the last couple of years? I mean, it's been nothing like Syria, for example, right?
No, it hasn't been anything like Syria, but it's certainly in the thousands.
Yeah. Well, I guess we'll see. how it goes. Wish some more reporters would go back there and write about it. Thanks very much for your time, Jason. I appreciate talking to you again, as always.
Sure, thanks for having me.
All right, y'all, that's Jason Ditz. He's at news.antiwar.com. Bookmark that, really. You can read about everything going on in the world that matters every day. News.antiwar.com. We'll be back in just a minute. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers? Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. And so, coming up on the show, Jonathan Landay is going to be on to talk about the Senate torture report. Landay from McClatchy Newspapers. It's coming out soon. Well, parts of the declassified summary. Anyway, we'll be talking with Landay about that. Right now, it's my chance to try to make the case against war again. First of all, this is all America's fault. I've been seeing people, really, including George Bush himself on Fox News, claiming he was right to say that troops had to stay forever. Are you kidding me? George Bush is the one who overthrew and killed Saddam Hussein and his sons, Uday and Qusay. And not only that, but their entire government. And the entire army. And the entire structure of their state. And instead, threw in with the Iranian-backed parties, the Supreme Islamic Council and the Dawa Party. And their militia, really, the Supreme Islamic Council's militia, the Badr Brigade. And what they did is they fought a five-year war. They didn't just invade the country and get rid of Saddam and make sure that his advanced weapons of mass destruction program was rendered inert. They stayed. Oh, we can't leave now. The violence will get worse. We can't leave now, they cried. Just one more year worth of intervention, 6 more months of this policy, and everything will turn around. But they never even acknowledged what the policy was. And the policy was helping the Shiite militias cleanse, as they call it, Baghdad of the Sunni Arab minority. In doing so, they gave the Shiite parties, led by Maliki, again, Iran and America's compromise choice, left them with no reason to compromise with the Sunnis at all. They'd taken the capital city, something they could have never done without the U.S. Army and Marine Corps to help them do it. And as soon as it was over, Maliki told George Bush, now get out, and don't let the door hit you in the ass on the way either. Sign right here this status of forces agreement that says you're out by 2011, at the end of 2011. Bush signed it. He had no choice. His presidency was over. And Maliki, the guy that Bush had put in power, told him, we don't need you, we're the majority. Because, see, the Iranian plan and the Iranian sock puppet parties, like Dawa and Skiri's plan, all along, as in fact I told you on this show, all along, was to break Iraq into pieces. They didn't want to rule supermajority Sunnistan. That would be incredibly expensive and difficult. But they could break off the southeast and keep it for themselves, and put their sock puppets in charge of it. And that was their plan. George Bush told you that Iraq and Iran were in an axis together. In fact, of course, his father and Ronald Reagan, as we discussed earlier on the show with Gareth Porter, helped back Saddam in his invasion of Iran. Really, Jimmy Carter was the one who gave him the green light to get it started in 1980, and included helping Saddam use his chemical weapons against Iran. So they weren't friends in an axis at all. They were enemies, and Iran used America to do their dirty work and get rid of the Sunnis, including torturing and murdering hundreds of thousands of them in order to kick them out of Baghdad. And so That's why the Sunnis of Iraq have aligned with the Islamic State, which is really just Al-Qaeda in Iraq, suicide bomber, prisoner beheader, and crucifier, butcherer, murderers of civilians, is because the Shiites have put them in a completely desperate situation, because the Americans put the Shiites in the position to do so. And so now what do we have? Now we have the very worst edge of the Sunni-based insurgency that the Americans fought from 2003 through 2006 and a half or seven. And, or the end of 06, beginning of 07. The very worst part of that, Al-Qaeda in Iraq, has now become so powerful, they've declared themselves a state. And they tried to do this back then in 2006, and it led to their undoing. They called themselves, after Zarqawi was killed, they called themselves the Islamic State of Iraq. And the local Sunni tribal leaders and religious leaders and just plain old Sunni Iraqi nationalists told them, go to hell. You're not the state of us. You're our helpers. You're the fringe here. You're not the boss. But now they've grown up. Well, what happened in the meantime? The tribes marginalized them. The awakening movement that David Petraeus took credit for was really the tribes telling them, like I was just saying, you've grown too big for your britches. And they were not all killed off, but they were marginalized and sent home until Barack Obama in 2011 decided that since the Arab Spring went against America's sock puppet dictator in Egypt and in Yemen and in Bahrain, and it was making us look really bad for supporting all the dictators in the region, for PR reasons, they would stab their friend Muammar Gaddafi in the back, who Bush had brought in from the cold in 2003, you remember, because he needed to pretend that the Iraq war had accomplished something. So even though Gaddafi had been begging to be friends again forever, well, for the first time, forever, they finally let him in order to pretend the Iraq war scared him straight, which was a bunch of crap. He only bought the AQ Khan's junk from the garage sale just so he could give it up in the first place. He never had a nuclear program. Give me a break. Anyway, so they stabbed Gaddafi in the back for the PR stunt. And then in the most cynical fashion, they decided to take advantage of the Arab Spring in order to work with the Saudis, the Qataris, and the Turks in order to try to get a regime change against their old enemy Assad in Syria. And yes, he had helped George Bush torture and murder Al-Qaeda guys for a while, including innocent people were tortured that the CIA rendered to Syria. He was a partner in the war on terrorism, but he's not quite the sock puppet dictator of America. He is much closer to Russia and Iran, obviously. And they decide they would go ahead and try to get a regime change there. And then, as we've covered this whole time on this show, Patrick Coburn and the rest on this show, it was Obama's and Prince Bandar's insurgency in Syria that re-energized the insurgency in Iraq. And right when they had the most to resent against the Shiite regime America put in power there, America and its allies are arming and helping encourage and support their rebellion just on the other side of the big fake border between Syria and Iraq. And so there's no surprise at all to listeners of this show that the once the Islamic State of Iraq and Syria, as they call themselves, broke off from the al-Nusra Front and said they wanted to create a caliphate, that they would be able to do so. People listening to this show, they've heard Patrick Coburn explain for a long, long time. They've heard me explain, because it's easy enough that the Shiite government in Baghdad doesn't really control those predominantly Sunni areas because they never really wanted to. Patrick Coburn reported about guys abandoning their posts, Shiite Iraqi soldiers serving Baghdad, abandoning their posts up in Mosul back a year before Mosul fell. Not just the day it fell. Anyway, the point is that now, even though the Islamic State has been powerful enough to claim all this territory, they're completely landlocked and surrounded by enemies. The American and Iranian, never mind even American, the Iranian-backed government of Baghdad and all of their friendly militias, the Badr Brigade, the Mahdi Army, and Asaib al-Haq, and whichever other ones we've never even heard of. There was one Fatah al-something. anyway. And then they got the Kurds up in the northwest and their Peshmergas. They've got the Turks who are friendly to them and certainly can protect their own borders from any northern expansion there. They've got Assad in the west. They've got Jordan, which has a crack army, which can keep them out, and it's too far to get to Saudi Arabia. So they're completely landlocked by enemies. And just like in 2006, they're the same totalitarians they were then that turned the Iraqi people against them then. There's every reason to think they could do that again right now without any American help whatsoever. And they're more likely to do it, in fact, without American intervention on their side. So all America really has to do to secure the destruction of the Islamic State is just stop. Just sit back and watch as it self-destructs. The more we bomb them, the more powerful we make them. It's as simple as that. After all this time, on one hand, we can recognize this is 99% America's doing. And it's the perfect time when the crisis is bad enough and can take care of itself enough that we can just stop intervening forever. No more few more years or else the violence will get worse. No more one more mission and then we'll have solved the problem. It's the solving that's causing the problems. We all can see that now, and now we can just go cold turkey, right? Why not? Oh, John Kerry's Mideast peace talks have gone nowhere. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. U.S. military and financial support for Israel's permanent occupations of the West Bank and Gaza Strip is immoral, and it threatens national security by helping generate terrorist attacks against our country. And face it, it's bad for Israel, too. Without our unlimited support, they would have much more incentive to reach a lasting peace with their neighbors. It's past time for us to make our government stop making matters worse. Help support CNI at councilforthenationalinterest.org. All right, I know. I need to pare that down, man. I need to get that done in half a segment, less. It's all America's fault because America overthrew the secular fascist dictator, and America stayed for years backing the Iranian-backed Shiites and putting them in power in Baghdad, and that's why they have no reason to compromise with the Sunnis, because Bush gave them Baghdad. Bush spent 4,600 American lives and hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of thousands of Iraqi lives giving the Shia Baghdad. And so they told the Sunni, ha, screw you guys. Why would they be loyal to some lines drawn by the British and the French? They got Shiistan, and they're keeping it. And so that's why they've treated the Sunnis so badly that they don't want to be part of Iraq anymore. They would rather ally with this guy, Omar Baku al-Baghdadi, and the Islamic State of suicide bomber, prisoner beheader, civilian butchering lunatic monsters, because the Shiite militias that America put in power and their army, they're just as bad, only from the other sect. And so that makes the Sunnis their prey. And so they ally with the Islamic State in an alliance of what apparently they consider necessity. Just like back during the worst days of the war and the occupation, the civil war for Baghdad and other places. Where they allied with Zarqawi in the first place, as long as he was helping fight the Shiite militias in the American occupation that was helping them. That's the real thing that I think would be hard to get across to people overall, is that it's not even that Bush and Rumsfeld used the terrible Shiite militias like the Badr Brigade to do all their dirty work. It's that the Shiite militias used Bush. Used the army and the marines that whole time that they thought, well, we're fighting for freedom. We're fighting to give these people a chance at democracy, which of course is not the same thing as freedom at all in the first place. But anyway, no, we're fighting for democracy. The people who oppose us, why, they're the extremists and the terrorists who don't want democracy. When that was never the fight between the people who want democracy and the extremists who don't. The fight was between the Shiite militias and the Sunni militias. That's who it was between. And America picked the side of the Ayatollahs. America picked the side of the Shiite majority. And now, what's a fun little thought experiment is, if you go back to 1991, when Bush encouraged the Shiite uprising, and then Bush Sr., after the first Gulf War, and then stabbed them all in the back by letting Saddam keep his attack helicopters. And in fact, as I never can remember the guy's name, but this one journalist reported and talked about on this show earlier this year, in fact, American military, I don't know, I guess Army helicopters, landed on the freeways. American helicopters landed on one of the highways and prevented an entire Iraqi army division from marching on Baghdad, which is what they were prepared to do, and Saddam wasn't going to be able to do a damn thing about it. And Bush, so he not only encouraged them to rise up and then didn't back them when they thought that they had backing, but he actually outright took the side of Saddam against him. And anyway, but the point is, if that had gone through, if instead of stabbing him in the back, well, sure, first of all, he shouldn't have had the war in the first place. You can start your thought experiment wherever you want. But anyway, your counterfactual, assuming the war, and assuming we got to get rid of that Hitler Saddam Hussein, if they'd been able to get rid of him, but the city was still very mixed and very like 50-50 percentage-wise and all of that, then the Shiite position, the Shiite militias and the pro-Iranian forces and all of them, they wouldn't have been in such a position to dictate all these terms. Now, maybe there would have been a full-scale civil war for years and years for the capital city between the Sunni and the Shia. But without the Americans in it, it's hard to see how. It seems like, no, it was because the Americans, it's, you know what, it's just like any other government program, you know? Why would the Shiite militias not use the Americans to help them kick all the Sunnis out of Baghdad when the cost is nothing? Americans die in it, and Americans pay for it. And they weren't powerful enough to do it by themselves. Not in a thousand years, they hadn't. It took the Army and the Marine Corps. It took the Republicans to give them that much ability to completely ignore the wishes of the members of the former regime and their constituency whatsoever. Because America gave them Baghdad. And so, yeah, I don't know. What a terrible mess. You think about it. Jimmy Carter and Ronald Reagan, they support Saddam and his invasion of Iran just because they overthrew America's sock puppet dictatorship that America never had any right to foist on them in the first place. But anyway, so just for revenge for that, they backed Saddam in his invasion and war against Iran, including helped him use his chemical weapons, which are the ones that were found recently, Reagan-era stuff. Not anything George W. Bush claimed existed and was being produced. And anyway, about 500,000 people died on either side of that. About 500,000 people. And then in the first Gulf War, approximately 100,000 people were killed directly. But then they also bombed the water treatment facilities. They bombed the sewage. They bombed the electricity. Oh, and they banned chlorine. You know, they banned anything that the Iraqis could do to solve the problems that they created there. And they instituted a total blockade, which was really, you know, unheard of in modern times, since World War One or something, where they had no one to trade with. Like the embargo against Cuba, they could still trade with the Russians. They could still trade with whoever they wanted, just not with us. But Iraq was under an embargo by the UN Security Council with the agreement of Russia and France and China and everybody. And there was no way out of it. And in fact, it was structured where only a new resolution could ever end it. It was to never expire. Anyway, it was a total blockade and it killed approximately 1 million people. A giant country, a wealthy country built up on oil wealth. And then Bill Clinton starved them all to death. Bush Sr. started it, and George Jr. ended it by going ahead and invading. But so there's another approximately 1 million people killed, so there you're at 1.5 million, if you count the casualties in Ronald Reagan's proxy war there. And then you count the first Gulf War and the blockade era of the 1990s, you're at really probably better than 1.5 million people. And then George Bush's Civil War killed 1 million people in his invasion on all around, you know. And that is the excess rate of death. That's not exact all combat casualties, but they count as were got killed by America, had been gotten killed by America. because of the deprivation, the malnutrition, the ill health, the catastrophic loss of their just basic systems of distribution of goods and services that people need to survive. Bush smashed their entire society into 1,000 pieces, killed 1 million people, created about 4 or 5 million refugees. Sure does start adding up. Don't you think? Maybe too many. Think too many? Possibly too many.
Hey, Al, Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. This nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone. We are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com. All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. Here in just a sec, you might tell I'm stalling for time here. Jonathan, you there?
I am.
All right, all set. Good deal. All right, y'all, so I got Jonathan Landay on the line. He does the national security beat for McClatchy Newspapers. That's McClatchyDC.com. And before we get to your big story here, which is big and important, Jonathan, let me ask you about yesterday's stupidity here. Someone on Twitter is asking if I've had expert commentary on this subject, and you certainly are expert, as probably the reporter most famous for doing the best work debunking the so-called weapons of mass destruction program in Iraq before the war for Knight Ridder Newspapers. The report is that some soldiers found some chemical weapons warheads in Iraq during the Iraq War II occupation there, and were exposed, and that it was covered up, etc., in the New York Times, a big piece by, I think, C.J. Chivers is his
Chivers.
Name. Chivers. Chivers.
Great. It's a great piece, Scott. Mm-hmm. Really fine piece of investigative journalism.
Yeah, it sure seemed like it to me. And now, apparently, if you only read the headline, what it says is George Bush was right all along. Landay was wrong. All the critics were wrong. And Bush was right to invade and overthrow Saddam and his sons and the Baathists because, look, mustard gas. So what do you say to that?
I say horse is what I say. If you read the story, you will then come to understand that these shells were pretty old. They had been basically abandoned and buried in pits. They were basically useless because a lot of them were leaking. And they were shells that the United States knew about that had been left over from the Iran-Iraq war. This is not what President George W. Bush and his vice president Dick Cheney and the rest of that administration was talking about when they were talking about Saddam Hussein having weapons of mass destruction. What they were saying is he's got them now. He's got active programs. He has revived his nuclear weapons program. He has got a biological program. He has got a chemical weapons program. And all of that is horse, as I said.
Right.
He had no such programs. They had all been basically detected by the UN weapons inspectors who had blown up his facilities and exposed the stockpiles. Those programs were not existent. Did not exist. Let's review some of the nonsense that we heard from the Bush administration. Now, one of the ones I remember is he had mobile biological weapons labs disguised as milk and yogurt trucks. That's the kind of thing. He had a facility outside of Baghdad where they were training Al-Qaeda to take over, to hijack aircraft. They had biological and chemical weapons facilities buried underneath his palaces and private homes and water wells and this kind of thing in Iraq. And all of that was just, remember the nonsense about the aluminum tubes that he'd been porting thousands of aluminum tubes to turn them into centrifuges, which are those machines that spin at supersonic speed to purify uranium into weapons grade uranium. We know that was nonsense too. And so what this So anyone who looks on C.J. Chivers' really outstanding journalism as being proof that Bush knew what he was talking about, don't know what they're talking about, and obviously haven't read the piece themselves.
Yeah. Well, and don't be too charitable now because, well, and I don't want to put words in your mouth, but he knew what he was talking about. He was lying. They were all lying. They announced it in the fall of 2001, just after September 11th. That this is, as William Sapphire called it, the big momentum. Something bad happened to us. That means we can do whatever we want for a while. Let's go get Saddam. And they announced from there on, it was an open conspiracy in every sense of that term, that we're just going to lie you into war for the next year and a half. Sit back
well,
and take
see,
it.
I'm not so sure. See, you and I have a basic disagreement there. And my disagreement with you would be that I don't know that some of them, or maybe all of them, were deliberately lying about the nature of the intelligence. What they believed is that they had intelligence from very questionable sources, Ahmad Jalabi and company, that said one thing, whereas the intelligence they were getting from the CIA, at least as far as the Al-Qaeda connection went, was nonsense. And I think they just chose to believe it. Don't forget they had that cockamamie effort that went on under Doug Feith at the Office of Special Plans,
sure.
Where they basically sought to discredit the CIA reporting on the connections between Saddam and Al-Qaeda to say the CIA doesn't even know its own intelligence, and here's all of this proof that he's working with Al-Qaeda, whereas it in fact, we know that that was nonsense. So were they lying? Let's not forget, CIA produced this, the U.S. intelligence community, led by the CIA, produced the National Intelligence Estimate in 2002 that said he did have a weapon, he had reconstituted his weapons of mass destruction program. He was trying to reconstitute his nuclear weapons program. So they were being told that by the CIA and accepting that from the CIA, but were rejecting the CIA's analysis on the fact that there was no connection between Saddam and Al-Qaeda.
Well, and also rejecting the conclusion in that same NIE that he would never use chemical weapons on us unless maybe if we were invading.
That they judged that there was a very high degree of improbability that he would ever turn his crown jewels, i.e. His weapons of mass destruction, over to an Islamic terrorist group because they could end up using them against him.
And now, but isn't it true, though, that at the very waning years, maybe even the last year of the Bush presidency, weren't there two big stories that came out about very high-level people in Saddam's government who were actively talking to the United States in the run-up to the war and were really and very credibly saying, no, really, we don't have anything? I mean, that's not something that would have just been only the CIA knew that but didn't tell the White House. The White House knew about that, right?
Well, you're forcing my tired, addled brain to go back and try and
remember. I'll Google it during the break.
But you can. But here's what I remember. I remember Vice President Dick Cheney, when they kicked off the whole propaganda move to try and gin up public support for the war, with this speech he made to the veterans of foreign wars in the summer of 2002, where he says something along the lines, we know that they have reconstituted their weapons of mass destruction program because we're being told that by defectors, including Saddam Hussein's son-in-law, Hussein Kamal. Well, the fact is that I don't know if he was consciously lying, but he was totally misrepresenting the facts, because you can, if you want to go on Google now, you can find the transcript of the interview that was done, or the interrogation that was done by the then head of the UN weapons inspectors, Hans Blitz, with Hussein Kamal in Jordan after Hussein Kamal defected, in which Hussein Kamal says, we got rid of it all. And so I don't know where the vice president former vice president got his information from. Yeah. But it, for, and I found this.
Well, and you know what, Jonathan? Listen, you're a hard news reporter. I'm not asking you to read his mind or whatever, but I would point out that he deliberately constructed his sentences there. I don't have the exact quote.
Oh, I
but
won't disagree with you on that. Disagree with you on that.
Because what he said was actually true, that Hussein Kamel admitted that he kept some stuff after the first Gulf War. Yeah, exactly. But it was still all destroyed by December 91. That's the part of the story
Hussein
he didn't
Kamel,
say.
In that same interview, gave up the biological weapons program.
Right. So that's what makes it seem to me pretty obvious that it was a deliberate lie, that he told a very specific half-truth that Matlock would have busted his ass for, you know. But anyway, I'm sorry, music's playing. We got to take this break. When we get back, we're going to talk all about the new torture report. Not that Dick Cheney has anything to do with that. With the great Jonathan Landay. Oh, we're going to find out where they got that info about that so-called terrorist training camp outside of Baghdad in just a minute. McClatchyDC.com. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future of Freedom Foundation. Edited by libertarian purist Sheldon Richmond, The Future of Freedom brings you the best of our movement. Featuring articles by Richmond, Jacob Hornberger, James Bovard, and many more, The Future of Freedom stands for peace and liberty and against our criminal world empire and Leviathan state. Subscribe today. It's just $25 per year for the back pocket size print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's The Future of Freedom at fff.org/subscribe. Peace and freedom. Thank you. All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. I'm on the line with Jonathan Landay from McClatchy Newspapers, McClatchyDC.com. And so McClatchy Newspapers bought Knight Ridder, and then they had their web guy do a wonderful thing, which was take every last bit of Landay, and most of that includes Warren Strobel and good old, what's his name, the columnist, too. They got all these archives under the Iraq intelligence section, and check out the URL, McClatchyDC.com/128. That's all you got to do. McClatchyDC.com/128. There you go, 128. And that is the full archive of, from the fall of 2002 on, Landay's journalism, talking with rank-and-file CIA guys, telling him what Cheney says isn't true. They don't have weapons. They don't have anything new. We don't have anything that says what they say is right. And Doug Feith has set up a lie factory over in the Pentagon, and it's all there, I swear to you. McClatchyDC.com/128. What could have stopped the war right there if enough had been paying attention at the time. As if truth could have stopped the war back then. But anyway, so Landay, he's on the line, and that's where you can find that archive there. And if you have anything more to say about the weapons of mass destruction, I'll let you. Otherwise, I'd like to switch over now to your most your latest piece there at McClatchyDC.com, which is about your sources who are reporting to you about the still classified but soon to be declassified summary of the Senate Intelligence Committee's torture report. So please tell us the latest there, if you could.
So according to people familiar with this report, it basically sidesteps the issue of the responsibility of the CIA's political masters, i.e. the President of the United States, George W. Bush, Vice President Dick Cheney, and others, for the abuses that took place in the so-called RDI program. The rendition, detention, and interrogation program, which we know used methods like waterboarding and others that most people believe, incurring, including the current president of the United States, constituted torture. And that so that whole aspect of, you know, the deliberations within the White House, the orders that came out of, well, we know eventually what order came out of the White House, the authorization to go ahead and do this. But we don't know sort of the deliberations that went on. We don't know, at least officially, the roles that were played by various actors within the Bush administration. We don't know, we won't know kind of the back and forth that was going on between the legal beagles at the White House and the Justice Department over what eventually became these Office of Legal Counsel legal opinions that effectively legalized torture.
Yeah. Well, and which is just a catastrophe, especially considering how much of that is already open source and how, you know, even I got all the names of the lawyers memorized. It's easy as pie, all the guys who helped justify all this stuff, not just to the CIA and the White House level, but for the Pentagon guys who also were under instructions that doesn't matter whether we've signed the Geneva Conventions, if the Taliban hasn't, and if the average civilian resistance fighter in Iraq hasn't, then it doesn't protect them. So go ahead and do whatever you feel like.
Well, not just that. I mean, here's the bottom line, is that this was the last official government investigation into this whole sorry chapter of American history. At least there's nothing on the books either pending or in the future that will go back and examine the role that the top officials of the United States played in this whole thing. And so therefore, this was the last opportunity to get on the record from an official body the roles that were played by these various actors within the White House. I mean, there's been a lot written on this. I've done a lot of writing. You've got some great books out there, like Jane Mayer's The Dark Side and various others, but those are unofficial accounts. There's been no official accountability of how any of this transpired within the White House itself. And so, yes, I mean, there needs to be accountability at the CIA, for sure, because, look, no one at the agency and no one at the Pentagon, no one stood up and said, I'm going to refuse to do this because it's against the law, and I'm going to expose this in the press. Nobody did that. So, there needs to be official accountability, and the CIA certainly needs to be scrutinized for that, which is what is happening in this report. Mm-hmm. But it ends up leaving them holding the bag. You know, being thrown under the bus is kind of like the sacrificial lamb, and it makes it sound as if sort of the CIA was doing all of this in a vacuum, whereas this program was a covert executive-level program. It had could only have been ordered by the President of the United States. And even if the report goes into that aspect of it, we won't know kind of the process by which it was all arrived at. Who was doing what? Who was saying what? And that's what we're not going to get.
Yeah. Well, you know, if there was such a thing as the rule of law around here at all, then it would have been in Nancy Pelosi's impeachment trial of George Bush, or hearings in the House and his impeachment trial in the Senate, that would have resolved all of this. And then, you know, whatever details would be left up to the federal prosecutors after that. Because, I mean, it was as clear as day, as you said, from all the unofficial accounts. He certainly illegally decided that it was okay for him to order other people to break the law. And to the extent that people were murdered and people were tortured quite in violation of the law by the tens of thousands, if you include all the people in Iraq and Afghanistan who were treated without mercy during, you know, that whole era, too. You know, like the way it filtered down to the night shift level wasn't explicit instructions necessarily, but it's what everybody's doing. Like Tony Lugaranis explained to Frontline, that we tortured everybody all day long. That was kind of our orders.
Well, when I step back and look at this in the grand scheme of things, there's a couple of things that occur to me. The first is that the Republican-controlled House of Representatives wanted to impeach a president of the United States for his sexual peccadilloes, whereas there's been absolute resistance, any kind, on the Hill to looking at the question of the illegality of the program that was used to effectively torture detainees held by the United States. None whatsoever. And so on the one hand, yeah, let's indict a president for his sexual peccadilloes. Let's impeach him for his sexual peccadilloes. But when it comes to torture, nah, we're not going to do anything there. The second thing that occurs to me is that I don't know that this would have occurred, you know, 20, 30 years ago here, because the United States did have congressional committees, bipartisan committees, that conducted some pretty intense, thorough, controversial investigations of presidents and the intelligence community, where there was bipartisan agreement to expose this stuff. I talk about the Church Committee that looked at the CIA's conduct during part of the Cold War. We had the Watergate Committee under Sam Ervin, where there was bipartisan agreement government to investigate the Nixon White House and the break-in at Watergate, as well as some of the other things that were going on, like the CIA opening mail, and listening to phone calls, and this guy, and the military getting involved in all of that. And there was no doubt that there was going to be a bipartisan agreement that was going to lead to the impeachment of Richard Nixon, and that's why he resigned. So fast forward to what we have today, none of that.
Yeah, it's a tragedy. And the precedent set, too. And Cheney and Addington, they really did succeed, especially in having Obama just ratify it all, the idea that no, really, presidents, as Richard Nixon claimed and was disproven back then, if the president does it, that means it's not illegal. And they really have gotten away with blue bloody murder, literally. And so, oh, and that's my last question. We have almost no time here, just a minute. But they claim only two were murdered by the CIA. Never mind the military for this part of the thing. But then the other Scott Horton, heroic anti-torture international human rights lawyer and journalist for Harper's Magazine, he says that three more were murdered, probably by CIA employees at Penny Lane, a.k.a. Camp No, down there at Guantanamo Bay, and that he thinks that's probably in this Senate torture report, too. And do you know about that? What do you say?
No, I don't.
Okay. I wish I could find out for your next big story. I know you got a good source or two here, so maybe you could ask around and find out if there are any higher numbers of murdered, because their little pseudo-investigation to see whether they would have an investigation was only on the two murdered. But if there are more than that, then that's, you know, maybe grounds to get another investigation to see whether to have an investigation over there at the Department of Justice, for what that's worth. Anyway.
Well, yeah, it's a good question, Scott. Unfortunately, I'm not going to be able to pursue it. I'm leaving for Iraq on a three-week reporting assignment on Monday.
Oh, okay, great. Well, I hope I can interview you from there, too. I'll be in your email box.
You know how to get in touch with me.
All right. Thanks very much, Jonathan. Appreciate
sure.
it.
Sure. Take care.
That's the great Jonathan Landay, everybody. Thanks for listening. We'll see you Monday.